So, my friends, we come to the last evening of this retreat with kind of the direction now has turned towards leading tomorrow. So, as part of this process, we want to leave well. And there's many things to well leaving in a good way that process happens. And one is to, sometimes is to review what happened. So I'll talk a little bit about this theme of the retreat, kind of sum it up in this kind of way. And maybe it's also a chance for you to speak. We haven't had any questions here in the hall, and it's nice maybe to have some questions from the teachings, your practice this week you'd like to ask, and we don't have a lot of time, so maybe three of you, one for each of us, and then tomorrow there'll be a chance for other, we'll do the closing circle downstairs, which is all part of the end. And then also ending, kind of when the direction shifts kind of to ending, it's clear that's what's beginning to happen. That's still just as much time for practice as arriving, as being in the middle of the retreat. And there's a long tradition in Buddhism that some of the greatest wisdom, benefits from practice, comes when you're coming out of a state of calm or concentration, coming out of a retreat. And partly that's because the reference point, the contrast can be so revealing of what's going on, that if you're quiet and still, if you're more accepting, more caring, more loving, compassionate, something, that creates a different perspective to see as your old habits come back. See the operating principles, what happens when you get to coming back into your normal, whatever that is, way of being might be. And you have a chance to see it in a new way. And some people, when they end of the retreat comes close, their mind starts thinking more. And one conclusion from that is the retreat's already over and I'll just keep thinking. I'll stop practicing, just have to be patient until they allow us to go home. And that's unfortunate because this is really a golden time. It's not as satisfying. You might be so calm as you were. Mind might be busier. But it's a really valuable time to keep being mindful. So the way that we bring this to a close is we go through a kind of alternation of a little bit more active in here. At this time of day and evening, we're usually quiet. We'll talk, we'll have questions, maybe a few questions, announcements, different things. And I have to be very careful at these closing evenings because sometimes I'm tired from being here teaching all week. And I kind of get silly. And then sometimes I say some things that I later regret. So it's all part of this more energy. And then we go back into silence. And the last sitting in the evening as usual, sleep, wake up in silence, continue as we were. And then right up until 9 o'clock. And then there's the cleaning period, which is more active again. Then we come back in here to sit quietly again. So there's an alternation of activity coming out of the retreat, going back in. It's by design. It's meant to be something to practice with and work with as we go along. And also, and then by the time that we're ready to leave, maybe around 1 o'clock, you're kind of ready. You're not going to leave here driving on the freeway at 25 miles an hour. You'll kind of know what's appropriate. So the part of the theme that I want to emphasize the most right now is the faculties. And faculties, I like to propose that we see the faculties as capacities for a certain kind of action. And it's a mental action, maybe, we can call it that. Rather than thinking of them as states that we're supposed to have and cruise around in, that they involve some kind of ways in which we show up. And a central aspect of the action of Buddhism is the action of showing up. Showing up for yourself, showing up for life, showing up for others. Really stepping in and being here in a full way. So you're really here for your life, for others, for the situation. And whether, you know, some, you know, if you're working in the kitchen as a veggie chopper, you know, you show up and you're really there to chop or be in the kitchen. And Joanne was really impressed how much the veggie choppers didn't just show up to chop vegetables, but apparently you also kind of went and helped the pot washer, kind of in between. And it was just apparently a wonderful kind of flow of everyone supporting each other. And the dishwashers were helping each other, and the pot washers, and they're all kind of this flow of, and you, apparently that whole group of people in the morning showed up and they were there and really there and present and in their action, in the way they behaved. And so something in us needs to act. You know, even, you know, the people who are most successful at being hermits, you know, sequestered and hidden away from the world, they really act, they really engage. They show up to be hermits. They're not sitting there, you know, against a tree, you know, spending all day twiddling their thumbs and, you know, just, you know, doing the, clipping their toenails for the third time that day. You know, they're like really doing it. They show up. It's an activity of doing that kind of maybe reclusive life. And so Buddhism is a lot about action. It's about doing much more, I think, than we often get the impression of when you listen to teachers like me. And but it's a, you know, it's a really, and so these five faculties are the ways we show up for the world. And so, and each of these five faculties are kind of like capacities we all have, and they can be capacities used for good and used for ill, things that can be used for wholesome, used for the unwholesome. And so for us to start showing up in such a way that we become our own teacher. And the way to become your own teacher is to be able to see the difference between what you're doing that's helpful and what you're doing that's not. And to be able to choose to engage in what's helpful. It can be as simple as seeing that you're telling yourself the same story about yourself that you've told yourself for 20 years, that somehow you must be, you know, the lousiest meditator on the planet or something. And then you ask yourself, is repeating that story to myself helpful or not helpful? And you have to admit, that's probably not helpful. So then you ask, is there something else that's helpful? Well, I don't know. I'm so lousy. But let me give it a try. Let me stretch myself and see, even though I'm so lousy, let me try. Oh, I thought of something. Maybe what's important is not that I'm lousy, but that whenever I remember, I start over. I just start over all the time. Like I'm starting for the first time. Let's try that. And lo and behold, every time that you're not mindful, you start over like it's the first time. Like you're excited. Look, I'm so lucky. I get to try. And by the end of the day, you feel refreshed. Wow, just that made a huge difference. I used to be exhausted by the end of the day because it's a big load to carry this big backpack that says I'm lousy. I mean, that's a really hard one to carry, especially if you, you know, add to it as the day goes along. But, oh, look at me, I get to start over and over and over. Is that silly? Maybe it's phenomenally silly. Maybe I'm just already starting to get silly here. But doesn't matter if it's silly to have this idea, let's start over each time. What matters is it made a difference. It helped. It was a better alternative to take. So that was not that it's that easy to come up with it, but you want to have faith that you can make a difference, that you can figure out what is useful And then have faith in the, in what's helpful. Have faith in the wholesome. Don't have faith in the things that are clearly harming you, clearly weighing you down. And there's these unconscious ways that we, something in us must have faith in it that we repeat over and over again. Which, in my idea, is that something must believe that it's beneficial to keep telling myself I'm lousy. Something must think it's beneficial to keep smoking cigarettes all day long, or whatever the alternative that might be. Something must think it's beneficial to be so cynical about everyone. Someone must think it's been, somehow I must, what is that? It's not beneficial, but what is it I, what have I faith in? What am I trying to do? What am I trying to get from this? Am I trying to make myself feel safe or happy or better than others, or what's going on? And then the question is, well, is there a better way? Let's have, to have faith, there's always a better way. And one of the core, I believe, principles of Buddhism, there's always a better way that's for the greater good of everyone concerned. It's hard to find that, but that's what why Buddhism is in action. It's then you engage in the activity. Well, what in the world is the greatest good in this circumstance for everyone concerned? And it might take a lot of thinking, figuring out. And then bingo, oh, that's what it is. And I've been in many situations where it seemed impossible, but having faith in this, we can find a way. Let's explore, let's consider, let's brainstorm, let's stretch, let's be creative. And then, wow, that is the greater good for everyone. And then part of the action is to persist, is to engage, is to put effort into it. And so there's a kind of silly thing, since I'm allowed to be silly now, that sometimes I say, you know, mindfulness, it doesn't work. It absolutely doesn't work. Sorry, now we tell you, 7 days in, it doesn't work unless you do it. It doesn't work if you don't do it. And so you got to show up for it. You got to do it, right? And you do it and do it. And then there's being present for what you do. It is showing up. Mindfulness is kind of just showing up, and really showing up. Showing up with all that you, all of who you are. That's one of the things I learned from Zen training, was to show up with everything, with my body, my mind, my heart. Really be pre- If I'm going to do something, just do it. And I really tried not to when I was a new Zen student, because I didn't want to do it. And then I discovered that I was so much happier when I just did it. Gave myself to what I had to do. I mean, it wasn't like I was doing bad things. I was chopping vegetables, washing pots. And I was the before just before I got to the monastery, all pot washing and all dishwashing happened by hand. And then just before I got there, they bought a dishwasher. And I was the first dishwasher, officially, the job. So I have my official, you know, certificate in Zen training, dishwashing. And just you show up. I loved it because I just decided it was a dance in the dishwashing shack. And I just, that's what I'm going to do. I just, okay, I don't want to be here, but since I got to do it, let's show up and do it. And it was just lots of fun. So to show, really show up for your life. And it can be done calmly, peacefully. It doesn't have to be a dance in the dishwashing shack with dishes, but it can be calm. Show up in a calm way. Show up in a kind way. But do show up. That's what mindfulness is. Sit down to meditate so you show up for yourself. What a generous thing to do. And then samadhi. I like to call this whole, to become whole. and to show up and let all of yourself to be there. Include all of who you are. You know, you probably, so many of you know that there's lots of people in the world, when they see you, they do not include all of who you are. Part of you is not acceptable to them. Part of you is somehow off, or I don't know what it is. Or they see you in a certain way, and, you know, they just think that really closely shaved hair is just really cute. And, well, I don't want to be cute. Only seen for my hair, thank you. And so it's sad that people do this. We do this to each other. But we don't have to do that to ourselves. Please. Samadhi is to, everything is included. All of us, to show up for all of it. And then learn how to be wise and kind and helpful about how you embrace all of who you are. Even the difficult parts, even the parts that are awkward, or even the ones that might even cause harm to you and others sometimes. There is the art of saying yes to all of it, so whatever is needs to be healed can be healed. And then comes wisdom and discernment. That's part of his, that's what really begins to discern and see what is helpful and what is not helpful here, so that we can choose the helpful. And to do, go through the whole day that way. After I spent 3 years, almost 3 years in the Zen monastery, there were two stories I want to tell, and then I'll stop for it. I told someone's story today. I went to see a movie. It was the movie Gandhi with Ben Kingsley. And I was a Zen monk and this intensive Zen practice, and I went and saw the movie in San Francisco at theater, and I cried during the movie. And then I was walking out through the lobby at the end of the movie, and you're not responsible for the first thoughts you have, right? So yeah, that's okay. So I had this first thought, right? And the thought was, 3 years of Zen practice failed. Because I cried in the movie. The next thought was, no, Gil, it worked. But the other thing that happened was that I became, in this monastic life, is you're practicing all the time, and it became obvious that that I had a choice all day long about how I conducted myself. And what I didn't know before I went to the monastery, which I knew afterwards, was I had a choice about how I sit in the chair. I never even gave any thought to how I sat in the chair. You sit in the chair, what's the big deal? But I learned that it makes a difference how you sit in the chair. So I went to the abbot and had a meeting with him and explained this difference. And now I really feel like there's choice, and I'm choosing how to stand, how to walk, and I feel more alive and more present and more for my life and everything because of it. And I gave him this example of sitting in a chair, and he did something really unusual for a Zen master in the Japanese Zen tradition, where you do all this bowing and formal things. And we were sitting cross-legged, very formally, you know, in robes, and he reached over and shook my hand. Congratulations. He wanted to kind of convey how pleased he was, I guess. So this, you know, choosing, you know, just this wisdom to choose. So these are actions that we show up for ourselves with. And I like to propose that something in the heart needs to know that we show up. Something in our heart needs to know that we are actors in this world. As Francisco talked about, producers in this world. We're not just consumers. And the terrible way to be a consumer is to specialize in being a victim. Specialize in being like everything is too much, that I can't do it. There is another way. And so something in our heart needs to know that we are In a sense, producers, we show up, we are there to live this life. And then as we do that, and we pay attention, we learn how to do it so that it can be peaceful, nourishing, beneficial for ourselves, and beneficial for the world. And these five faculties are these five things that can really support us. So I hope that the discussions we've had about these on the retreat have given you enough appreciation of them that you're interested in seeing now how can you bring them into play in your life as you go forward from here. And may those little decisions you make about how you sit, maybe, or what you tell yourself be ones that brighten you and brighten the world. May we all act in such a way to make this world a better place for all of us. So thank you. So now we can, if maybe three of you have questions, and maybe we can start asking. One first question can be for Liz, and then Francisco, and then I'll do it. And then if it all goes quick, Zen style, then we can maybe do more. But if it's a Vipassana style, then we'll barely do three. So where's that mic? Yes, could you maybe? I saw Vijay's hand up. Thank you.
Thanks for that last talk, Gil. Can you tell us what you learned about sitting in a chair?
Well, remember, the first question is for Liz.
Oh, for Liz.
Hey, what have you learned about sitting in a chair?
all kinds of things. So first, that it's not an inferior alternative to sitting on the cushion. That was lesson number one, because for a long time, you know, I loved sitting on the cushion. And then, oddly enough, I don't even know how it happened or when it happened. That for a while, I would switch between the cushion and chair. And then my knees gave out to a point with arthritis that I couldn't sit on the cushion anymore. And I had conversations with other Dharma practitioners where somebody said, oh, yeah, you know, I've never been able to get concentrated in a chair. Fortunately, I ignored that and just, you know, learned about sitting in the chair. It's, you know, I love that the Buddha recommended all postures. So to be able to get concentrated, I've heard stories about, you know, Tibetan masters who can be concentrated in the loudest, noisiest train station. And so that's aspirational. I want to be conscious and aware in all postures. So embracing the chair.
Vipassana centers in Thailand and Burma seem to specialize in being in very noisy places. And, you know, and you know, they're loudspeakers that are terrible quality, screeching loudspeakers that are playing sometimes all night long. And the worst of it is when they, for 7 days, they just recited Abhidharma text over and over and over again. But the next was they kept in Burmese over and over again. They kept neighborhood, kept playing the song My Madonna, Just Like a Virgin. And luckily it was in Burmese. I mean, so, you know, so we have, you know, Highway 17 and people across the street, but this is like nothing compared to what it's like in Asia. So a question for Francisco. Hmm? Oh, yes, yeah.
Yes, thank you. I got really curious this afternoon if there is such a thing as too much mindfulness or being meditating too much. And I wondered, is there like a law of diminishing returns, like with physical exercise? You know, you exercise and it's good for your body and you keep exercising and you keep exercising, but it does get to a point where if you keep going, it starts to break the body down, even though you can keep going, like you can keep running or stuff, but then it starts to be hard on your body and hard on your joints, and it's not so great. And it can be not so great without you really realizing it until later, maybe the next day or the following week, when you start to have horrible pain in your body and you go, oh, what did I do? I was wondering if there was anything like that with meditation, like if you can do it too much to the point where it's not beneficial, maybe you're not even cognitively aware that it's not beneficial and you're doing it too much until later something happens to you. I don't know. Is that something? Is that a thing? Yeah, I was curious. That's all. I've never heard anybody ask that question before.
excuse me. I think as a general response, there is... there can never be too much mindfulness. If the mindfulness is really mindfulness, and if the mindfulness is in some form of, doesn't have other elements involved, some over-efforting or something inappropriate with your given conditions and circumstances, there might be time that for certain circumstances and conditions that it's not mindfulness, or mindfulness in some other form, maybe not sitting mindfulness, maybe simple open awareness practice outside or something. But it depends on the conditions and the forms, but mindfulness is, if it's mindfulness, it's always a wholesome thing, but it depends on the unique circumstances of individuals at different times. There are some conditions that it is not advisable for, but those are some mental pathological conditions.
So my question is, out of all the senses we have, when we are silent, I somehow feel that the thoughts... Oh, sorry. Can you hear me now? Can you hear me? Yeah. So with being silent, I know we cannot keep our eyes closed or ears are always open, but I see there is something miraculously different when I'm silent for more than 3-4 days, that thoughts somehow started to vanish or it started to settle down. What is so peculiar about being silent? What's causing that lesser amount of thoughts when we are silent?
Good question. I like it. My entry point to this was when I was 20. I lived on a farm, a small dairy farm. And the farmers went away for a week, and I was left alone to take care of the cows and the farm. And I'd never been alone in my life before, completely, for that amount of time. And the only person I saw the whole week was in the distance. I saw the mail carrier. And I wasn't thinking about anything except just being there. And after about 3 or 4 days, my perception became really acute, and everything was sparkling, and I was aware of every thought, And I'd never done before, but each thought seemed to sparkle. And it's just like, wow, this is cool. And I think some of it is that what happens in that kind of situation, but also on retreat, is that we're not getting a lot of input that's stirring us up. So it gives the mind a chance to relax, come back to, I would like to say, come back to a natural state. But so much of what goes on in our life and our reactions to what goes on in life is spinning out the mind. It's activating the mind. And then we have to think about things. We upset about things. We want things. But when you go to a situation like this, that you really can drop away, things can get quieter. You know, if the teachers had every day sat down, before we're going to give a Dharma talk, we want to tell you the headlines in the news. And we'll start the morning that way too, because it's important to stay on top of the news. And we'll probably end the evening because, you know, you're supposed to check regularly. And, you know, you probably none of you would have settled at all. So that's part of it. And then if you keep your eyes down and you're not, you know, interacting with people, then things get quieter and quieter. And there's one of the lessons of doing that, though, is at some point we discover that what's keeping us active is ourselves. It's not the news, it's not the other people, but what we're doing to ourselves, the spinning, the reactivity, the of our own mind. And that can be quite painful to see, and especially when it's out of control and we don't seem to have any ability to stop it. But that's actually a very important insight to see, and that's the beginning of some kind of new relationship to our own mind. Okay, thank you. So then, before Tony makes some announcements that you need, announcements about the closing and what you need to know, at this point in the retreat, we do what's called an IRC appreciation talk. And it's one of my favorite things to do because I appreciate this place so much. What I heard from Joanne about the people in the morning work period, that just seemed we're in Burma. That just seems to kind of represent the goodness of this place and what this place is about, where we come together in community, we support each other, we care for each other, we, you know, are doing the work to make it happen for ourselves. And I just loved hearing that. And that was acts of generosity and mutual care, respect, it was wonderful to hear that story. And so that's kind of like this whole place is built on that. And it just inspires me. Sometimes I kind of almost pinch myself when I come to IRC. Is this place for real? How did this happen? Because there's so much goodness here. There's so much goodwill that people come here and offer this place. So much generosity, so much gratitude, so much wisdom, so much practice they bring, so much maturity in being a community and being with the practice and finding our way with it all. And that, you know, that we've been thriving for so long for now is just a great, one of the great bright lights of my life, if this is the case. And I like to highlight it at this point in the retreat because you have all, one way or the other, have benefited from this. And the idea is that the medium, not that, isn't that the medium is the message, the medium is the food. The medium is the heart food that we have here, that you take in how much this place really only exists. Everything from this, so many well-meaning people want you to be here, have dedicated time, money, resources, intelligence, planning, consideration, researching, in order to create a place, to have a place here that you, people like you, can come and have this experience of practicing in this kind of environment. That you can, so you can take it in and be benefit from it. You know, I don't think it takes a lot of thinking to realize this is a little bit unusual in our world. And I wish it wasn't. But it's unusual to have this level of wholesome way of people live together, relate to each other, and engage in a life that this place here is about. And so for you to take the last hours you have here, to really let yourself be fed by it, let yourself be inspired by it, let yourself kind of be changed by it, so that when you leave here, you can bring this into the world, some of these values, some of these different ways. Maybe you can go into the world with more generosity, more goodwill and kindness, more support, and ready to support people and help, and without expecting anything in return, without asking for anything in return, just generous thing. And I hope it's contagious, so that before long we'll have more of these retreat centers across the country. Not we necessarily, but there will be more of these kinds of retreat centers around the country. Maybe our first goal should be one in every state. So, thank you.
As we begin the gradual transition of return